Hi, I'm Jennifer Carraher, and this is Unfinished Truths. From misattributed parentage and assisted reproductive technologies to made or chosen families, these are stories of and by people who gain truth through knowledge and want to share that truth with you. As David Foster Wallace said, the truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you. Hi, welcome back to Unfinished Truths, Season 2, Episode 2. And today I have interviewed the writer Dawn Davies. Dawn is the author of Mothers of Sparta, Memoir and Pieces, published by Flatiron Books in 2018, which won the Florida Book Award Gold Medal for General Nonfiction and the GLCA New Writers Award for Creative Nonfiction. Her essays and stories have been Pushcart Special Mentions and Best American Notables. Her work can be found in McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, The Missouri Review, Poetry Northwest, The Alaska Review, Narrative, Fourth Genre, and elsewhere. She teaches creative writing and helps writers reach their publication goals. She is also a certified trauma recovery coach and works with the NPE-MPE population. She lives in Florida. Her coaching website can be found at littlebirdcoaching.com, and her author website is dawndaviesbooks.com. That's Dawn, D-A-W-N, Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, books.com. I also need to mention that this episode has discussions of suicidality, so if you are struggling with thoughts of self-harm or suicidal ideation, please dial 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or why not just program 988 into your phone for you or anyone else who might need it. This is a national 3-digit code for the suicide prevention hotline, and it is in effect now. This has been up and running since July of this year. So again, 3 digits to remember are 988. If you are interested in the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey, or ACEs, that Dawn and I spoke about, it can be found at the CDC website under Violence Prevention. I will also put a link in the episode notes. And if you get into this, you may want to check out some work on trauma-informed care, especially if you work in healthcare or the ancillary professions, or if you think you yourself just might benefit. Gabor Mate is a scholar who studied the relationship between stress and disease. Originally, he was the trauma-informed scholar, or he was the trauma-informed care guy in the harm reduction community. And he wrote the very renowned book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which I highly recommend. But he also has many great books about somatization of stress and how trauma affects the body, which Dawn and I discuss at length. This is written about in a book that he just published this last month called The Myth of Normal. So check that out if you have time. We also talk about BPD, or borderline personality disorder, and other mental health issues, which you can read about on the Mayo Clinic website for a general discussion, or the National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI, website. And for clinical descriptions, you can always look at the DSM. And with that, I would like to introduce the amazing Dawn Davies, a phenomenal writer, a quick mind and wit. She is charismatic and insightful and thoughtful, and I hope you enjoy her interview as much as I did. I really enjoyed our conversation. So check out her work on Severance, or again in her book Mothers of Sparta. Her website has many links to her online work. And with that, thank you for always coming back. I'm very humbled by your presence and by having such a lovely audience. Thank you so much. Today, I'm talking to Dawn Davies, who is an author. She has written Mothers of Sparta, which is, in my opinion, an extraordinary collection of short stories. They're short stories, yes. Is that correct, Dawn?
They're essays, actually.
Essays. Mm-hmm. And you had aptly subtitled it A Memoir in Pieces. Your push cart winner for an essay in our very own Severance magazine, which most people here know about, but there will be links to it available. Your writer, your writing coach. So if I get this, I want to get this like right off the bat, because what I would, you are what I would describe in having read the essays in your book specifically and your essay on Severance magazine, a very honest writer, and you're also an NPE. And the reason that's interesting to me is because of the way in which honesty about an experience, like you're talking about and writing about honesty about an experience that is fundamentally sort of counter to honesty, in my opinion.
Super interesting. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
Thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm super happy to be here. I'm really grateful for your work in the NPE world. And I love what you're putting out, and I'm so happy to be part of it. Oh, but I am now thinking frantically about the 6-7 things that just came to mind about how we would talk about being a memoirist while growing up without having truth as a fundamental understanding of my life, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm actually writing about that now. I sent you an essay that's not out yet, that's going to find a home soon, that talks a lot about that. And it's something I'm wrestling with a lot. So it's strange because I am an honest writer. People have called it visceral because I write about mm-hmm. things that my body does. I write about things. I'm very introspective as a writer. So the lens that I look at things is through my own thoughts and my own personal experience, which sounds selfish, but it's the way that I work. It's how I understand the world and my place in it is by examining what has gone on in it. So, you know, there are a lot of people who write beautifully about like personal essays, about non-memoir essays about society and culture and stuff. And I just don't do that. I'm a memoirist. So I write about my relation to the world. So as an NPE, I've been doing a lot of thinking, you know, like, how do I write about this? What's fair to write about? What is ethical to write about? I've got people in the family who are still living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you read my memoir, you said.
Yes, I did.
Thank you. That's so nice.
I did quite a while, right after it came out, I think.
Amazing.
A couple of years ago, yeah?
2018. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, I wrote about family there. But when you create a story, when you create a true story, a memoir, you're creating a persona that is really a part you, but it's a part not you. You create the view you want to show to an audience, right? So you create, so a guy named Carl Klaus is a beautiful writer and a writing instructor, wrote a little book called, The Self Made of Words. And basically what you create is a self made out of words. So it's not you, but it's a little bit part of you, right? And as a memoirist, there's an ethical considerations you have to have when you're writing about people who aren't you, because they don't necessarily choose to be characters in your story. They're in your life, and some of them don't choose to be in your life either. You know, they just happen to be in by family or children that you have or people you grew up with. But when you write about them, they then become characters. So there are ethical considerations that you have to think about. And I do think long and hard about it. And I really haven't written much about it until recently. And partly it's because I've been thinking, how am I going to do this without screwing it up? How am I going to do this without hosing anybody? How am I going to do this and still be basically respectful of people in my life, right? And then the other part of it is I haven't been able to write about it because it's taking this, I found out in 2017, and it's taking this, what is that, 5 years ago? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 5 years ago now. Yeah. It's taking the 5 years for me to get to a place where I can actually finally I think I'm just out of the rage phase.
Yeah, I totally understand that, especially the idea of the rage that comes from the MPE experience. I definitely have anger. So I can understand that coming out of this discovery. And, you know, that all goes back to this lack of truth and everything. But I don't think that people always understand. Particularly people who I have spoken with that don't have an NPE experience or don't have anything that's in this realm. They don't understand that rage. So I'm wondering if you can explain what you mean by that.
Yeah. So how do I talk about this so others can understand? So of course, every NPE is going to, we're all driven to hear each other's stories. And that's what I love about the NPE community, first let me say, because we are all really here for each other. We are here as witnesses to everyone's stories. We support each other. It's really lovely. But, and it's, I think it's, I'm so grateful that we have it because we really only have that. With the exception of maybe we might get a spouse who is understanding. I know that I heard you in one of your podcasts saying that your spouse is amazing. And my husband's the same. He's unbelievably perfect, right? He's listened to me talk about it incessantly for probably 3 of the 5 years that we've been doing this. It was like 3 years.
Yes.
And the other thing is, like, he was sick when he had cancer when I found out. So he was going through cancer treatments and I was trying to like bury everything and like not talk about it, but I could not talk about it. It was a really hard time in our life, right? But so here's the thing. I feel like my experience certainly, and other people I've heard said the same, that there's a knowing that we have somewhere in our childhood and in our pasts, we know that something's not right. We know that we don't fit. We know that we may not belong. I felt like an outlier in my family, you know, and I know a lot of people have said that too. And people will say, oh, we're a dirty little secret, right? Or we're a secret. We're the family secret. I don't think it's a secret. A secret is something that's meant to be told when the time is right. Like, yeah. I don't know, like a surprise party, right? or like, oh, I've got this promotion, but I can't talk about it until my contract is up or whatever, right? That's a secret. But a secret, if that you never intend to reveal, is a lie. It's a lie.
Exactly.
Right. And when everyone in the family, as was my understanding in my case, my birth certificate dad had told me that, everyone knew, really, you know, and he had told like my brother-in-law, I think my sister knew and people knew. And I asked him, well, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't anybody tell me? And he said, oh, family loyalty. I'm like, but I'm family. And I guess I wasn't family. Right. So that lifetime of the NPE secret keeping and that denial of the truth is, I think it's extremely traumatic for a child while they're going through it, even if they don't know that that's traumatic. And I think that trauma can affect the brain as well as other parts of our bodies and our mental health and, you know, affects us physically. And then in my case, anyway, I had all these other things that were going on that were presenting themselves. I had like OCD as a child. I had very severe anxiety, very severe like perseverations of thought of death, suicidal feelings. And turns out that I think it was OCD. Like OCD, there's a type of suicide OCD that you get where you think can't stop thinking about it. Doesn't mean you're going to do it. But I also had trouble forming attachments. I had an eating disorder. I had no boundaries with boys because I had no dad who was there. I developed migraines, like risky behavior, a complete dissociation from family. Like I didn't go home on the holidays. Like, and all of this was, boy, Dawn's just a hot mess, right? Dawn needs a therapist in high school. Dawn is the super anxious. Dawn can't handle change. Dawn is the one who's all this stuff. Dawn had to do that. And it turns out when I look back on it, these were absolutely natural reactions to absurdly ridiculous situations.
I am identifying with everything that you're saying. Is as a little kid, I was always identified as the one who was crying all the time. Or I was always like somaticizing everything. Or 100%. You know.
Yeah. No.
Also, the OCD. Like, if I do X, something, you know, catastrophic is going to happen.
Oh, 100%.
But what's really funny is that whole idea about this like somatic manifestation of trauma. I think that's interesting. In that you're talking about trauma that we didn't even understand was existed.
I agree, and I think it also has to do with the fact that people weren't acknowledging that children could have traumatic experiences in childhood. You know, people who had trauma were people who came back from war back in the day. And I know that like trauma is thrown around a lot now, like, oh, my trauma, and everyone's got trauma and everyone's been traumatized and stuff. And I think a lot of people have, but I don't think that everyone, you know, I don't think you necessarily have to be victimized in trauma. I don't think you have to maintain like an identity of victimhood to be have been traumatized as a child. And I think it's important that we talk about it, right? And I don't think that certainly NPE families that have the type of family dynamics that can support that type of lie. And also generally, you know, we're in our 30s to 50s, most of us. I know some are in their 60s and stuff. We didn't talk about like the effects of any adult's behavior on the children back in the good old days, you know, we didn't. And so that was like a double opportunity to not have knowledge, if that makes any sense. You know, it was 100%. It was a very clear way to ensure that there'd be nobody talking about it.
So you're a trauma recovery coach. Is this what inspired you to pursue that?
This is absolutely what inspired me to do it. I didn't understand that I had trauma. And I actually had a couple of instances, and I talk freely about everything because it's life. It's nothing to be ashamed of, right? I had actually sexual trauma as a young person, right? So I had some incidents in a daycare that I went to where a man took photographs of me, right? And I didn't know there was anything wrong with that because my parents drove me there and left me there. And then I went there and then it happened. And, you know, I don't think anyone touched me. It was just photographs. So I do have like a lot of like ugly feelings, like fear, fearful feelings, thinking that there have been people who've seen me naked as a little child. Do you know what I mean? So there's that. But then when I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12, we moved every couple of years. So I was always that kid who was trying to get into a system of girls, like a friend group. Every couple of years we move and I'd have to start over, right? And I got with this group of girls and they had a sleepover. And then I was 12. I actually wrote a short story, like a disguised autobiography of this. And they tied me up at a slumber party and did sexual things to me while my hands and legs were tied, right? So there was that. And I didn't think that was trauma because I don't know why, because you don't talk about it. And, you know, then I, like, when I was barely 15, I was went to a party and a 20-year-old took me into a room and had sex with me. Mm-hmm. And I had no boundary. Because I had no understanding that there was anything about me that was remotely good, right? Like, because I felt so discarded in that family, you know? And, you know, oh, well, woe is me, it's so sad. But, you know, it's just was a fact of life and that's how it was. So I grew up thinking that that's what normal was. Oh, I've not been sexually assaulted. I'm totally fine, right? And then when I had this NPE discovery and I was able to look back retrospectively on all the stuff that was on what happened in my life, like none of that was normal. This was all gaslighting. There was nothing wrong with me. I was fine. I was sensitive because there was shit going on that people didn't tell me about. And when I asked them about it, they lied and said, no, I was wrong. So if you hear that over and over and over again, you're not going to think much of yourself. I ended up like doubting other thoughts that I had and other ideas that I had and other opinions that I developed. Well, that must be wrong too. Or maybe I'm wrong, or maybe there's nothing right about me at all. You know, and I didn't think like that all the time, but that was my default. The problem was mine. Something's wrong with me. You know, and my birth certificate dad later, when he knew that I knew, told me that he thought he knew who my biological father was all along, right? Like he knew before I was born, he said. And he didn't admire the man because he was a guy they all went to high school with. And the guy was tall, blonde, like me. And he was a very oversensitive, like, guy who had all the feels, right? Like he just was depressed and you know, he felt things very hard and he had trouble adjusting and he ended up later going to prison for cocaine and like some other things. But that's who my birth certificate dad thought my genetic stock was. So there was something about that allowed him to kind of write me off emotionally. Like there's nothing that's going to fix her. She's super broken. Right. So I had 4 years of understanding this and I thought, you know what, this is actually really traumatic. I took an ACE score. Do you know the adverse childhood event test?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. So I took it and I'm like, I'm fine. This is great. I'm going to have a one or whatever. And it was pretty high. And I'm like, oh, this is a real thing. And there's no shame in exploring it. And then once I started, I went into therapy, and then I decided that I wanted to learn more. So I ended up studying it. And now I'm certified as a trauma recovery coach. So that's the long version. I don't know of any trauma recovery coaches I know therapists who don't identify with having traumatic childhoods, but I don't know any trauma coaches who have not gone there first because they were exploring their own traumatic events.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say that I will put a link to the ACEs on the episode notes just because I think that it would be interesting for other NPEs or anyone really to, you know, answer the questions and see how you score. It does help to inform how you see yourself and, you know, how you put your childhood experiences that felt traumatic, you know, or unusual or however you want to categorize them. It helps to put those experiences in a new light in terms of how you see yourself, I feel like. And so I'm just sort of wondering for you in terms of processing everything, all of the trauma in your childhood, did all of this manifest in a bigger way when you found out about your NPE status? I don't know what to call it, really, but your NP about being an NPE or MPE.
I'm going to talk about the physical side first, because from a very young age, I had a lot of somatic experiences, right? And, you know, so for anybody who doesn't know what the ACEs score, the ACE test is, it's basically Kaiser Permanente and the CDC did this study back in the 90s that gathered a bunch of data from all genders, races, all a bunch of socioeconomic levels, like all socioeconomic levels, and discovered that the more trauma you experience in childhood, the higher your risk for chronic disease, right? So it's not just like, oh, you have tick marks and you've had childhood trauma. No, it's a connection to like serious chronic diseases. There's depression, violent behavior, heart disease, asthma, cancers, that kind of stuff. You know, for if you have a, what is it? I think I remember the stat. If you have a ACE score of just 4, your chance of depression increases by 460%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this isn't something to be dismissed. It's real. It's physical. There's data, right? And so I didn't know that. I don't think that like getting sick is simply for the unlucky, I'm air quoting unlucky here, or for people who don't eat right or people who have bad genes, right? There's an epigenetic component to chronic illness that has been studied enough that it should be mainstream. Like
it's called cortisol. Care. I mean, right?
Yes. It's called cortisol. It should your pediatrician should be able to talk to you about this. Your primary care doctor should be able to talk about the way we understand the flu or a broken bone. Yep. Mainstream. That's how mainstream it should be. You know, there's a really good book. It Didn't Start With You by Mark Wolin for anybody who wants to read more about it. But until 2017, I had all these physical stuff. I had tons and tons of them. I had, I lost half my hearing, my eyes, my vitreous detached from my eyes. My thyroid ate itself. I lost the ability to produce tears and spit. Like I had chronic migraines. I've had nerve stuff in my face and neck. If I talk for more than an hour, I lose my voice. I have like some low-key facial paralysis. I can't get numb at the dentist. Like all this stuff, it's all in the body. It's all in my body, you know? I have Lyme disease, Epstein-Barr reactivation, chronic fatigue, anxiety, fibromyalgia, all that stuff. I'm like, oh my God, I'm a hot mess. I had emergency heart surgery in 2015 for sudden, like potentially dead arrhythmia that no one could ever explain. When I was 11, my neck went out for the first time, 11 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And then my whole life, I've been a hypochondriac. You're a hypochondriac. That's not even as thoughtfully descriptive as health OCD, right? Oh, you're just a hypochondriac, which is a very negative term, right? It's kind of scornful, in fact.
Yes.
But I think it's all been trauma. I think it's all been childhood stuff that I've stuffed down my whole life, right? So in 2017, I think by 2018 and 2019, when I really started working on it, I'd always been working on it, but I really started doing some deep work on it. And I've had a lot of physical changes that I'm healthier now than I have been. And so it's not to say that it was in my head, because you can still test my blood and weird stuff shows up, but I don't have the pain I used to have. Something about my body doesn't hold it that way anymore. I mean, I do a lot of stuff. We do ice baths. I do saunas. I do, mm-hmm. I eat really carefully, you know, but I've always had this. It's just since 2017, 2018, 2019, as my understanding of how difficult the NPE discovery was when I started to be able to put the pieces together. That makes sense?
Totally. And I'm thinking, as you're talking about, like, I am very much like you. I have tons of somatic things that are going on all the time. And I often have described it as a body awareness, like hyper awareness of my body. But also coupled with that was a like horrible dysmorphia when I was forever, like up until like I met my bio family, really. Something started to make sense. But I wonder if it's an NPE experience.
Do you think it's genealogical bewilderment?
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I had it too.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Because I do remember when I met my grandmother, my bio father's mother, who's 94, mm-hmm. and I looked at her, and the things in her face that I noticed in myself, suddenly I was like, oh, that's, you know, I love this about you. So things mm-hmm. Things you hated about yourself or whatever, you know?
Oh, there were a lot of things I hated about myself that I now do not hate at all. And seeing my father's picture for the first time and learning like that some family members had certain characteristics that I have, it erased it instantly. Like it was an instant erasure of the, mm-hmm. the hatred I had. Like I had a lot of hatred for my hair because I have really like big hair mm-hmm. and big hair is beautiful and I love it. And it's like my favorite hair. Other people's big hair is my favorite hair, you know? Like if I could have an Afro, I would have an Afro because if it just floats off, it's stunning to me, right? Except for on my own head, it wasn't, because everyone in my family had very sleek, straight, like, you know, black, beautiful, mm-hmm. shiny hair, mm-hmm. you know? And I didn't. And so I didn't even want to get pictures taken with the family. I was horrible in pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
I felt such shame.
Yeah.
But it was instant erasure.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talk about, and this is like goes off of the body awareness thing a little bit, but they talk about how they like find solace and just because we're talking about when we found our bio families, they can find solace or like even joy in the families or the identity or the likenesses or whatever, you know. And I personally did not get there for a long time. And mm-hmm. even now, I think when I feel like for every gift that there is from this experience, there's an equal grief. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of wonder, like for you, are you having an experience like that? Is it all joyful at this point, like 4 years out?
No, none of it's joyful. I don't think there's really not much joy. I think I can have a little bit of hindsight gratitude for it mm-hmm. because even in the, so I really don't have a lot of anxiety anymore, but even when I was meeting my father, I got a chance to, I think I only met him 4 times before he died. Right. Mm-hmm. And I had, I think, I don't know, I counted it. It was like 1,000-something days that I had together. We had a couple years together, 3, 6, 2 years. No, 800. I don't know how many days. It was a couple years. And I really only saw him 4 times. And during that time, my body was still a disaster, like a nervy disaster. And I was very anxious because I had been rejected from this other father, low-key rejection, chronic low-key rejection all the time. And then some pretty overt stuff where, like, you know, he asked me to leave his house at 15 and my parents were divorced at that time. And like, he didn't really ever talk to me and, you know, mm-hmm. just really weird stuff. And then by that point, my sister and mother and I were estranged. And so there was just this fear of rejection, another rejection. And I didn't think I would be able to withstand it. So I had a lot of, anxiety about it, even while I was there, even though I was able to be happy and in the present and joyful, but I was also still very anxious while I was in the moment. And I have regrets about that. Like that's me. that's something maybe I could have worked on years earlier, but who knew that was going to be happening? You know, like get your anxiety in check now, Dawn, in 2003, because in 2017, you're going to need to not be anxious. Like nobody knows, nobody knows that. Right. But, and I have gratitude for time that we had together. So he died a couple years ago, and I was able to be there for the last, I think I spent like 5 or 6 weeks there when he was sick, and he had cancer, and it was a pretty rapid decline, and I was there to, you know, to be with him and care for him and be with his family a bit. And I'm very, very grateful for that, but I don't have joy about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so here's where I'm messing myself up in the head, and I'm trying to write about it a little bit as I was reading a little bit. So I made the mistake of thinking that stoicism would help me.
Yeah.
Like passions are rational. Life should be waged as, you know, intense feelings should be avoided. Life should be waged as a battle against passion. Right. But I don't think that I was even remotely able to use that to help me in any way through this NPE experience, because my feelings were volatile. They were ecstatic. They were despair. They were cautious. There's a whole bunch of them that swung like a pendulum, and there really was no stasis. There was no calm place where I existed during that time.
Yeah, I still feel like that a lot of the time. So, hear you. The fact that you did get to know your father very briefly. Well, I guess that this is the question. Do you feel like you knew your father, or rather, what do you feel like you knew of him? Because my experience of my father is that what I know of him, or the him that is to me, that I knew of him in this time period in which, as a like full grown adult, that I'm meeting him. Mm-hmm. So both my experience of him and probably his of me, it's profoundly different. Mm-hmm. Than actually knowing him. Does that make sense?
How is it profoundly different? How?
Because I don't feel like I know the person. I don't know. I feel like his interaction with me is different maybe than it is with the rest of the world. And who knows, maybe it would have been that way if I were his daughter from day one, right?
Do you think it's more formal?
No, not really, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's just mm-hmm. different. So I feel like I think I know things of him, about him. And I think I know him in a certain way, but I don't feel like I know. I mean, I don't know if I would know him as a person necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know what to say about that other than, you know, it could be a result of his personality and something that he's bringing to the table. But yeah. I also feel like I had a similar experience. Like, you know, I know some things about him. I mean, we sat and looked at, you know, old family photos, and he kept everything. So I saw everybody's marriage certificate, their death certificates. I saw he was a subtle genealogy record keeper guy, although he didn't believe in DNA testing or anything like that. I know where his family came from. I know when they came here. I know that there were some very startling similarities that he and I had mm-hmm. together, that we each had. Like some of it was, we had the same hair. We each had colitis when we were younger. We each had Bell's palsy, like the facial paralysis. We each had a near-death experience at the age of 21. We were each the first on the scene of a car accident where a girl died in our arms. I wrote about that in my book. You probably read that.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
So he had that happen too, when he was the same age I was at that time, you know?
That is
like we were sitting at dinner and we bit our tongues at the same time at dinner. So there were so many strange similarities that made me feel good. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that I learned about him, like about who he was, like, 'cause I asked a lot of questions. I feel like I had to work to make my, allow myself to be happy that that's what I got. Because it was a very formal love, but it was also a fatherly love.
Yeah.
You know, he loved me. He was very thoughtful. He was very attentive to me. He called me every week.
Yeah.
You know, he heard that I once said, oh, I love spice gumdrops. I don't know why I said that. Like I hadn't had spice gumdrops in 10 years, but he came home with a big bag of them for me. Like when I was visiting. So he's just very, very, very lovely man. And I heard about, you know, he was like a real pisser when he was young and he really had temper and, you know, he, you know, like very loyal to the death for people, ride or die kind of guy, you know? And I love that. And so I have to think that that brief time that we were together, when myself finally made sense, that has to be enough. And I've allowed that to be enough.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question about your NPE status. So what you're saying is that everybody on your mother's side of the family, or your mother and your stepfather, everyone that was associated with them knew about the fact that you were in NPE?
I don't know if it's everybody.
Did your bio dad?
No, he did not.
Oh.
He had no idea.
Oh.
And he had said, and one of the things that were really, really far for healing was he said, "Oh, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. I missed your whole life. You know, I missed your whole life." And I was like, I'm sitting here choking back tears, like, oh, but I'm saying, well, that's okay. Cause we're together now, you know, like this fawning optimist, you know, like, it's all okay. We've got each other now. And that wasn't at all what I meant or what I felt, but that's the only thing I could think to say. Right.
That's so great. You know? To say that, because I get super irritated when people say that. Not irritated, but I do think, like, if an NPE tells me that and they're like, oh, what's the big deal? Like, you know, we get each other now. We get each other from this point forward. I'm like, do you have no like existential crises in your life ever, or just in this moment? And when people, my dad never says it, but people in his, you know, in his universe do say that a lot. And for some reason, it really rubs me the wrong way.
It rubbed me the wrong way when it came out of my mouth, but it was a fawn reaction, right? So that's part of the thing that I do when I get nervous, is I want to make sure everyone else is okay. Mm-hmm. That's my go-to. That's my move. That's my big move. Right. I always think of that. What's that movie? Crazy Stupid Love with Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. Did you see that movie?
No, I don't see any.
To see that movie, because there's a thing where like he's like kind of hitting on Ryan Gosling's hitting on Emma Stone, and Emma Stone is like, all right, what's your big move? Come on, show me your moves. What's your move? Because he's like a guy who like picks up a lot of girls, and she knows this. So she's like, all right, what's your big move? And so every time I say that's my big move, I think about that movie. I can't not think about it. So I now use that's my big move probably a little too often. But that's my go-to compensatory behavior. So some people will fight, some people will be flight, some people will freeze, and I try to make sure everyone in the room is happy. And so that's what I did with him. But it's disingenuous, and I don't think it's like the other thing. Do you ever hear, oh, you should just forgive your mom?
Yeah,
it's your mother. You know, why don't you just forgive?
Mm-hmm.
It was only one lie. No, it was
an entire
lie 14,000 times, right?
Yeah, exactly. With one lie over the course of 40 some years, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, I just didn't want to say my age there.
That's okay. We gloss over the deets.
You write in your book, Mothers of Sparta, a lot about being a mother. And I just have this thing that happens for me a lot, this like there's the being a child and being a mother and how those things intersect. And sometimes in the case of the NPE experience for me, they rather than intersect, they more collide, because you're trying to become someone's daughter at the same time, you know, trying to be a mother. And I find that to be confusing sometimes.
So are you talking about becoming your father's daughter?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So and parenting through the NPE?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a little one too. So that's different.
Well, I have a big one too, but
yeah, I know you have a big one. But I had, all mine were big ones when mine happened. And there was, you know, and I think I heard you say something like you wish you had like had found a way or had a better way or could shield your younger child from going through the experience with you. I'm paraphrasing badly.
Yeah.
I feel that way about even my children too, because there's a thing that my mom did which was to kind of parentify me, and I became like a confidant sometimes, mm-hmm. far too young, right? There were things that I won't talk about, but like I shouldn't have known things when I was a certain age, and I shouldn't have heard her talk about certain things at a certain age. And I was far younger than my children were when we went through it too. But now I have some, I don't know if it's regret, because I feel like I needed them at the time that I did, because I have two daughters and they're just hilarious and wry and funny and delightful, and they're all over social media. So like when we were looking for my father, I didn't have an easy time of it with the DNA because his family was very private and nobody really ever searched. So I ended up finding out, like, I couldn't see anybody close on GEDmatch on any of the main ones. I had to go to GEDmatch, which is like leveling up, because so I would find surnames. So we were, my daughters were looking up the last names of people who would show up on my GEDmatch and looking up people who were in the certain region where we were from and stuff. And so there was this massive photo search that went on between with them and me. And it was like one of the best things that they could ever have done for me. And I was very, very grateful, you know, but they also saw me falling apart. And I'm sorry that it happened, but it also happened. And also when you have children in their 20s, adult things happen, and it's okay to fall apart. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing when you have a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. And I wasn't falling apart in a bad way. I was just really emotional. And I talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, internally, I was suicidal. I really was. I really thought I was just better off dead. There was no fixing it. And I was actively suicidal. Not actively. I was in my mind wishing I could die every day. I was not actively. Like, I never tried, and I don't think I ever would. But it was very serious. So if anyone's listening to this and they feel like this, please, you can get help. There's a suicide hotline, you know. We can put the number down in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to activate anybody if they're thinking about it and they don't have support when they're listening. Because you can also get past that too. And just because you think it doesn't mean you're going to do it. It's very complicated. And I think when I'm looking, I don't know what else you need to do. You need to be really clear about the things that you're going to do. And I thought I was clear, but I think that generationally, that stuff just passes down anyway.
Yeah.
So one of the questions I have now, when I had daughters who were, I don't know, 20 and 22 when we were going through this. Yeah, that's about right. 21 and 23, 2022. Was any of that harmful to them? Mm-hmm. You know, like, was any of my experience that bled out into their lives harmful for them? I don't know. But what can you do? What do we do? It's really hard to be completely level-headed and a rock while you're going through the most traumatic experience of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the way you were talking about it, and I know it, you were talking literally about in your mind, mentally being suicidal, but in a way, and you've written about this, and I've talked about it a lot, it is like a death. I mean, you certainly are grieving the loss of a self that you thought you knew for your entire life.
Yeah, I agree. It is a death. And I think that, you know, I've heard other NPEs say that they felt that where they hadn't been in their lives before, they felt this thing like, I don't even know how can I live through this? There is no way to live through this. It's so profoundly difficult. And I think that's where they're like, I'm better off dead. You know, and that doesn't mean you're suicidal, but I think that I've heard, and I've seen a couple of casual, like anecdotal, like surveys of NPEs, and they have felt like that. And it is a valid feeling. We are affected that profoundly. And that doesn't mean that something's wrong with us at the same time.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, I just find it really difficult to write about my own experiences, but in your writer's coaching workshops, you specifically work or have worked with people who want to write about the NPE experience. Is that right?
I have a few who do that. I actually started working with just general, like, professional, semi-professional, like career memoirists who were writing books, right? And mm-hmm. I started working with, like, how do I call it? Advanced creative writers. That's what we'll call them. Advanced creative writers. And I know that they all ended up, they're like, oh, we're kind of stuck. I'm stuck. And gee, I'm stuck too. And everyone was stuck. Well, why are we stuck? Well, you're writing about the hardest thing that ever happened to you in your right. life, right? Oh, wait, that's trauma. That's trauma. That's a traumatic experience that you haven't figured out how to put on paper yet. This is what this is, right? And that's also how I got into trauma recovery, because I started accidentally doing it with my writers before I was certified. I'm air quoting that too. And I didn't do it as a trauma coach. I did it as a creative writing coach, helping people to write through hard things, right? So that has evolved. And I now have 1, 2, 3 people who I'm working with right now who are writing NPE stories. My writers don't necessarily want to publish. Mm-hmm. My MPE writers, they want to make sense of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it.
Because if you can put it on paper, then you've articulated enough in your mind to where it's not just swirling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And in terms of your NP experience and your writing, is that something that you ever want to publish about, or is it something that you are doing for yourself?
No, I'm like almost, I don't know, almost everything I write, I publish. I don't know if that's true, but mostly everything I write, I intend to write. I write with the intention of publication. So I'm actually writing a memoir now, and it's not like Dana Shapiro's Inheritance. There's no chronological story. It's just like, I write best when I relate seemingly disconnected events in a life to each other, and I put them together, and I weave things from some of them in some of the other essays. And that's just how I do it best. That's where I'm at right now. Right. That's the type of painting I'm doing. That's the style I'm doing. And so I'm writing a collection of essays about this right now, and I'm probably 2/3 done. I've got one essay's already out, and I'm sending one out. Two are out. One's already published, and I think I'm ready to write about it. Yeah.
And how are you dealing with the issue that you talked about earlier about, I mean, I know your bio dad has passed, and I'm sorry to hear that, but the ethics of writing about something that's a part of so many other people's lives.
There's a really famous quote by a writer called Annie Dillard who says, I'm going to paraphrase it. I never get quotes right. I also can't tell a joke perfectly. Like, I always paraphrase a joke and it doesn't come out good. Right. But it's something like, if people wanted you to write about them well, they would have behaved better.
Right.
Which sounds like a blanket excuse to write anything you want. And it's not, because you still have to be very careful with the choices that you make. But the way that I write, I don't write other people's stories. I'm writing my story. And so you own the story. You own your story. It's yours. You can do what you want with it. It's just like your money. You know, my birth certificate, dad died 3 months after my biological father died. And my sister, who I grew up with, hasn't spoken to me in 2 years. You know, I've spoken with my mom a little bit, and there's been no healing there. So
is that all in relation to the NP experience, or is it?
Yes. No,
really?
It's mostly that. There's some depth to it that I won't bring up in the podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's mostly that. And my mom has indicated that it's not likely to ever change. Like, she's just done. And so, okay. I mean, I'll just write my story.
Wow.
You know, it's very sad. It's one of the saddest things. It's one of the saddest things that evolved from this whole experience, but it's also out of my control.
Yeah. Were you close growing up?
No. Yes. We wanted to be. I wanted to be. There was a 5-year difference, and she was my birth certificate dad's biological daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I didn't understand how jealous I was. I was very, very jealous. Very jealous. She looked just like him. They were two peas in a pod. I mean, they were really, seemed really connected. They remained connected their whole lives. And so some of the problem obviously is me, is my behavior and my opinions of things and my attitude about things and stuff. But it's just unfortunate. Fallout is a terrible way to describe it, but it's nothing that I would have chosen.
Yeah. But also you wouldn't have chosen to have it kept from you all that time. Things would have played out differently. So.
No, they would have. And so part of the problem when the secret, the lie is discovered, right, is that the family dynamic that grew around it to keep it safe gets shaken up. You know, it becomes disrupted. And there are usually some people within that family system who are very invested in it staying the same.
Mm-hmm.
But for the NPE, it can't stay the same.
Right.
And so when the NPE refuses to play their role anymore, sometimes things fall apart.
Right. That's what I would say. I would classify that as roles too, because you see that the people in your family growing up, how each one holds a specific role.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I don't know if you were like me, but growing up, I was bucking that anyway. But then once the NPE thing happened, it's very hard to maintain that position.
Yeah, because we need the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's not supportive of what is true. That the NPE is the, excuse my French, the effed up one, I won't say it, I'll just, is the screwed up one in the family. Is the NPE is the screwed up one in the family, right? Well, guess what? The NPE is not. The NPE is reacting and has all along been reacting to an abnormal situation with basically the way normal people would respond. You know, they're a little closed off. They're a little doubtful. They're a little bit I don't know, disconnected. They don't feel like a part of the family, or they're angry and they don't know why. And then once they find out, they're legitimately angry and they have a right to be. Mm-hmm. But because it was set up for them not to have a right to have the feelings that they've had their whole lives, no one's happy with them having these legitimate anger feelings. No one wants those feelings coming toward them. They become very defensive. A lot of times they shut down. Not a lot of times. I'm like, oh, I know every single family. I don't. But what I've heard and what I've personally experienced is that the dysfunctional dance they did, they can't do that dance anymore.
Right.
You know,
that's absolutely true, I think. So is there anything else that you're working on that you want to tell us about? Any other writing that we can look forward to?
There's some like secret squirrel stuff going on that I'm not going to talk about yet because I got to wait.
And if people want to read things that you've already written, can I give them the website, your writer's website?
Yeah, you can give them my writer's website, because there are some links to, you know, some things are published on online now, which is nice. So back in the olden days, it was when things first started going online, there were these literary journals that would come online, or longtime print journals that would now have an online component, and everyone turned their nose up at it, like, oh, that's not real. It's got to be published in print, right? But
yeah,
now there's so many really good online journals or really good online components to journals that still publish in print, that I don't think it matters. So I very happily publish both in print and online, because online, you know, you can, 10,000 people can read it in a day. There are some links to some of my online work, including the short story that I wrote, Giver of Life. It's called Giver of Life. My website is dawndaviesbooks.com.
And I want to just plug, well, your book is excellent, as I said before, Mothers of Sparta, but as a mother and as a mother of like a little guy and a big guy, the story that opens the book, Night Swim, I'm sure you get a lot of feedback about that from parents, but that's very, very moving.
Thank you. Do you want to know a story about that essay?
Yeah, please.
So what's cool about that is, so, you know, the whole book took me like, I don't know, 4 years and, you know, 2 pounds of two gallons of blood and 5,000 gallons of sweat to do. And I wrote that essay in 2 days, right before we decided, like, on the final proof. It was very close to it being done, and they were going to submit it to go into production. And I'm like, wait, I've got one more. And I wrote it in 2 days. And sometimes the magic just happens like that. Like, I'm not saying the essay is magic, but it wrote very, very easily. Like, the two essays later after that was an essay that took me 7 years to write, right?
Well, I think the essay is magic. So well, I would say that. And that's funny, because the way I write is also, I write very, very quickly. Obviously, yeah. I need to do a lot of editing after the fact, but I always feel like I feel very satisfied with my writing when I come up with things that have been written in that way.
Isn't that nice? That's a gift when that happens, because sometimes you really have to slog through things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you talking with me today.
It was really nice. It's going to be one of those things where we had such a good conversation that I'm not going to remember everything we said. So I'm going to be surprised when I listen to the podcast.
Yeah, same. And hopefully we can be in touch.
I hope so.
Because now I have your story. So thank you so much for being here with me today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your afternoon.
It was absolutely my pleasure. And I love your podcast. Please keep podcasting. And I look forward to many years of you helping people tell their stories.
Oh, thank you. I look forward to reading you for years to come as well.
This has been Unfinished Truths, stories of new kinships and the truths they reveal. If you would like to share your story with me, please email unfinishedtruths@gmail.com or visit the WordPress website linked on your podcast platform.
Everyone has a story to tell.
Thank you for listening.